Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show with me, Robert Bound. The keen-eared listeners among you will have heard us briefly discuss today's topic a couple of weeks ago when we did our summer look-ahead show. We felt that this novel deserved a little more airtime, so today we're re-cracking the spine on David Nichols' new book, Sweet Sorrow. David Nichols is, of course, the author of many smash hit stories such as One Day, Us and Starter for 10, all of which have been or in the process of being adapted for the screen. And that's another area that Nichols is very familiar with. He picked up a BAFTA for adapting Edward St. Albyn's Patrick Melrose series for TV last year, and among other things, he also wrote the screenplay of Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd for the 2015 film. So Nichols is a man who knows his way around a good story, especially a love story. And that's where we find ourselves in Sweet Sorrow, a coming-of-age tale set in the 90s about an unremarkable 16-year-old boy called Charlie Lewis, who may or may not have just flunked his GCSEs, but that doesn't matter, because that summer he falls for Fran Fisher, a girl from the posh school in town. It's a tragicomedy about youth, family, first love, reinvention, and finding your feet. Oh, and William Shakespeare, because our love story takes place as our protagonist finds himself playing Benvolio in a summer amateur dramatic production of Romeo and Juliet. And joining me on the programme today to discuss Sweet Sorrow are Georgina Godwin, host of Monocle 24's very own books programme, Meet the Writers, and John Mitchinson, co-founder of Unbound Publishers and co-presenter of the literary podcast Backlisted. Welcome both to the programme.
Hi.
Well, you've been bathing ourselves in the warm waters of David Nichols' novel. It feels good in the summertime somehow to be inhabiting this universe. And this novel takes place in the sort of long, hot summer in the mid-1990s. John, what sort of world are we inhabiting here in David Nichols' Newey?
I think we're inhabiting a kind of, certainly Charlie, the main character, low middle class boy living in a sort of English town in, as it were, Sussex, Surrey. Kind of far enough away from London to be distinctly not metropolitan.
In the sense of the creepy crawlies.
Slightly conservative, you know. Yeah. His mum, he's the recently the product of a broken home. His mum has moved out and moved in with somebody else. And his dad, who was running a cool jazz shop in the town, the business has collapsed. He's gone bankrupt. And he is spending a lot of time at home, not looking for another job, playing jazz records, drinking too much on antidepressants. And Charlie's a pretty unhappy kid. I mean, he's having sort of anger issues. So it's a pretty familiar kind of territory. I mean, there are lots of books, I guess, who start like this, but very few. I mean, Nichols takes this boy and brilliantly. I mean, fans of The Inbetweeners will love
They're very good on lads.
Banter between him and his friends is I mean, I've got three, not quite now, teenage boys. They're moving out of their teens, but it's so accurate, the smell and the endless kind of playing ridiculous pranks on one another.
And very specific references to Lynx Aztec really does remind me of
dancing,
school.
Dancing himself. And there's some, I mean, lovely comic stuff as well as the sort of the darker. And then he meets a girl. He's gone off to read and he bumps into this girl and then she's hurt her leg and he meets a whole new group of people. The Full Fathom Five Drama Company, who are rehearsing to do a summer production of Romeo and Juliet. And she persuades him to join in.
And, of course, he absolutely loathes that. He's not a joiner at all.
And he's sort of pretending to be a sort of aesthete when he's reading in the grass with his shirt off, smoking a cigarette. And there's obviously a beatific, poetic quality to this, but it's completely by accident. It's completely out of character for him. But she sees the sexy side of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, then he's forced to do all of those terrible sort of trust exercises and beanbag throwing and all of the things that if his friends saw him, he would absolutely die.
The setting is this sort of rather fancy house on the outside of a kind of old rambling house on the outside of town, inhabited by Bernard and Polly, who are these aging thespians.
Yeah.
As he said, Polly, lovely woman, lousy actress. But they're very enthusiastic and they put on all this ghastly vegetarian food, you know, which eating all these sort of terribly overcooked beans has catastrophic effects when they're doing the trust exercises and the bending exercises. So there's a lot of this very, very beautifully turned observational comedy. But the book is kind of, he's taking on the great a kind of, I suppose, work of first love in the language, Romeo and Juliet. And you think, not Romeo and Juliet, for goodness sake. I mean, that tired old... But it's amazing what he does.
But there's a sense of embracing the corniness of that, yeah. And having the parallel love story of the play and of his and Fran's. And he's interesting on that. We'll kind of come to some of the you've mentioned sort of his father and some of the kind of rougher edges in the novel, John. But what about the love story itself?
You know,
it's very like most of them. The actual love bit is very short.
It is, and
no spoiler.
He actually says, "But love is boring. Love is familiar and commonplace for anyone not taking part. And first love is just a gangling, glandular incarnation of the same."
Which is sort of a critique on the fact that, you know, as he says, the bit in Shakespeare where Romeo and Juliet are together, communicating. Alive is could be the size of a pamphlet, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So there are these sort of critiques on how you deal with love in fiction and how you deal with love in drama, I suppose. And he's very good on that, isn't he?
He's extraordinary on it. And he also, I mean, he writes about how he says it is a love story, but that it's actually four or five love stories. And he talks about all the different ways that you can define love. And just going back to what you were saying about the gang of boys, very much in between us, but also it put me in mind of something like Guy Gunaratne's In This Mad and Furious City, that whole thing where you've got these boys trying to be so macho, but actually at one level they're being terribly, terribly caring. And, you know, another kind of love, which ultimately, well, no spoilers, but yes.
It's funny. I mean, the funny bits are very funny.
Very funny.
It's very tender. It's sort of a kind-hearted book, isn't it? I mean, it's told by Charlie, first person narrator, looking back on his life,
which is a very clever frame.
Yeah.
Because at a certain moment, the first section, you're suddenly back into Charlie now, looking back on 1997. He's about to get married, not clearly to his wife is called Neve, wife to be is called Neve, not clearly to Fran, who's the love interest in the book. So you're already beginning to see that what Nichols, I think, is doing is showing you how a person goes from being a 16-year-old child to being a sort of, you know, man in his early 30s, and how that summer was the sort of pivotal point. And it's all of these things could be done really, really heavy-handedly. But they're not. I mean, I think he's very subtle. Some of that's the structure. Very short chapters, lots and lots of dialogue, and he lets go enough of the, you know, sort of the proliptic looking into the future, so that it's very cleverly written.
I love the fact that we know it's not going to last.
Yes.
From the very beginning.
Yeah.
It sort of, I don't know, it allowed me to relax a little bit, I suppose.
And I suppose it's sort of it's in some way following that storyline of Romeo and Juliet, using that as the exemplar, where you know how it's going to end. You know it doesn't sort of end well, although for him perhaps it does.
Well, there's also a lot of very, very good criticism of the play in there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff like the first character he's going to play is just one of those characters that appear in Shakespeare that get about three lines, and then he gets Benvolio, and Benvolio is a very, very difficult character to make anything other than a sap.
Yeah.
You know, he
calls him like a sidekick, and kind of like, you know, he's the kind of backup guy, he's the wingman, you know, all the time.
And there's an extremely funny scene where they do the read through. There's an idiot, kind of sort of very, very kind of confident public schoolboy who's going to be Romeo, who's continually swigging water. There's this the most hydrated sort of actor in England. He drinks his water when other people are speaking, because obviously the play is basically all about Romeo.
In the eponymous role, he keeps on going on about the eponymous role.
And Charlie, the embarrassment level. So Charlie has to read Benvolio's part. So he decides he's just going to read every word as though there is a full stop after it. And then, of course, everybody says, this is terrible. We don't want you to act, but you have to put a bit more into it than this. And then the kind of the love thing, which is, again, could be corny, but she coaches him. And actually, through the coaching, she's rather, you know, she's got rather interesting insights into the play. There was a bit I didn't spot about one of Romeo's speeches that was a perfect sonnet,
that's a beautiful critique.
And
of that,
you know, to drop Lit Crit into a love story, a modern novel, and not make you think, oh, he's showing off, is pretty good.
It was done so well, and also the fact that I had never really noticed that Benvolio does actually disappear halfway through the play.
Yes, he does. I can't think of what to do with
him. That thing that there's that thing of seeing these big walls of text coming up to you, you know, when everybody's reading. And it's, it's all of the bits, the Amdram stuff is very, very beautifully and precisely observed.
Because, of course, Nichols used to be an actor.
Yeah.
So, and this was, his second novel was Understudy, which was sort of very much about this world. And in fact, in One Day, I can't remember the name of the female, our female protagonist in that, but she kind of goes off and tours the Midlands in some sort of touring rep company and all the rest of it. So we've talked about, the characters are beautifully sketched. There's a lot of comedy in them. They're quite tender. John, you mentioned that Fran takes him off into the fields around this big country house where they're rehearsing for this play and teaches him his lines, and they get sort of better, and that's when they sort of fall in love. And he doesn't seem to get any better as an actor, but he gets better as a person, and I suppose that's the point. I mean, she teaches him how to sort of fall in love.
And how to be kind, and also how to be confident enough to get beyond the banter, you know, the kind of oppressive banter that he... there's a particular scene where he...
The sort of pressure of having to be with his mates.
He drinks too much and throws with some force a pool ball at the head of one of his, and it kind of lodges in the wall, and then... I mean, he's crossed some sort of hidden, you know, kind of adolescent boundary, and his friends, you know, he's also way too drunk. And then that's the one bit of the book where he comes home and his father looks after him. Father actually puts him to bed and brings him tea in the morning. And also Fran, the banter between the two of them is some of the best stuff in the book.
Yeah.
Just the wittiness that with which you've watched them falling in love. I mean, he's a master of that romantic dialogue, I think, without it becoming, you know, I was wondering about, you can never really get very far from Richard Curtis.
Yeah.
I mean, I very much thought about throwing in a Richard Curtis as a comparison, but it's too close. And but I think Nichols whereas Curtis, sometimes, you know, that kind of saccharine stuff is turned up too high. He never does that. And that's one of the things I admired about the book.
We said in the introduction about Nichols' screenwriting, adapting the Edmund St. Aubyn, the Patrick Melrose books by Edmund St. Aubyn. As his novel writing career continues, can you see his work as a scriptwriter, Georgina?
Absolutely. I mean, as we were saying earlier, it's the short chapters, it's the pin-sharp dialogue, it's that acute observation, and that's all terribly filmic. Yeah. And I think that if you look at his work from the beginning, if you're going back to his very, very first work, like something like Us, perhaps, to here, you will see an evolution, a natural evolution, and I think that comes from his honing his skill as a screenwriter.
What do we think of that? Because as you said, John, the chapters are very short, dialogue's pin sharp, it's funny, it moves along at a certain pace, it's got a very kind of, you know, it's a propulsive thing, despite the plot is quite slim in many ways, but there's always enough going on to kind of drive you onwards. A lot of people kind of are cynical about books that seem filmic because they feel like they're begging to be made into films. Obviously, Nichols's books don't need to be begged to be made into films. But what do we think about that when we talk about a novel in filmic terms? Are we just using the wrong language, or you know, people sometimes mean it as a critique?
I guess part of the challenge is always how do you record the movement of a mind with, you know, that internal dialogue. Of, you know, the great sort of Russians, you know, it's really, really, if you boil, you know, Anna Karenina down to plot, you're missing so much of the point of the subtlety of the internal kind of hopes and aspirations and nightmares of the main characters. So I guess what Nichols does, which makes it more filmic, is that there isn't much description. He reminds me of Jonathan Coe in that regard.
Yeah.
He's interested in bringing characters together and watching them spark off one another. And it's a brief period of time in the book as well. So, you know, you're not trying to cover decades. I mean, he does leap forwards and backwards. And I think, you know, it's hard not to, when you've got jump cuts and voiceovers and kind of big scenes, you know, and you're working towards a sort of a theatrical production. I mean, I wouldn't imagine that he sets out to write it as a film, but I think you can see that the concision, particularly with the dialogue, that how do you get stuff to happen by people talking, you know, the showing, not telling, is that seems to me to be very filmic. I mean, it's a much better novel than you might think it would be if somebody says it's a first love romance. He's a much better writer than that.
So before we turn to your recommended reading and what it reminded you of and put you in mind of, I want to talk about a little bit of those sort of dark edges. John talked about his relationship with his father and obviously that wonderful point where he gets really pissed and then has to be looked after by his father. Mostly it's the other way around, that idea of having to care for those that perhaps should be caring for you. Mm. How true does that ring, Georgina?
I mean, enormously. He says, care suggested compassion, integrity, selflessness and devotion. Mm. And I had none of these. Not a carer then. Was resenter a word? Live-in resenter.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh my goodness. And that really chimed with me. My mother lived with me for 14 years, the last six bedridden. So I completely kind of get that. And I think the terror that this child, and he is a child, I mean, he's 16, but he's this boy coming home thinking, please don't let my dad have killed himself.
Yeah.
And just worrying all of the time about this. I mean, he has some wonderful things to say about nostalgia. And one of those relates to that. He says, the greatest lie that age tells us about youth is that it's somehow free of care, worry or fear. Good God, doesn't anyone remember?
It's a brilliant line.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
In terms of the tone, it's a tough trick to pull off, that having that relationship with his father, which is often very tender and quite funny, because we've got this, you know, and when his mates kind of say, oh, we saw the jazzer, you know, and they're kind of taking the mickey out of his dad and his relationship with his father, which is obviously very tender, but hugely compromised by all the problems that have happened in his father and his mother's marriage and all the rest of it. It's a very tough trick to pull off, presumably, to have that and then this kind of very light the love story and then the lightness and the banter with his mates and stuff.
I mean Harper, who's his sort of best mate, who has looked out for him a bit with when, I mean, obviously his life fell apart, there's a marvellous scene where they have a conversation which is basically him serving notice on the kind of person he's been, and he's moving off to do different things. It's all done through a pool match.
Yeah.
So it's really, again, it's just brilliantly done, you know, your shot.
Yeah. I met this girl.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, yeah, you're on the black. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I also think the whole relationship with nostalgia is an important one. He quotes at the beginning of the book from one of my favourite novels, So Long, See You Tomorrow, by William Maxwell, from which he perhaps also borrowed a little bit of that looking back. But the great line of Maxwell's is, in any case, in talking about the past, we lie with every breath we draw.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant in that book. It's a brilliant way to start off, because you're already thinking, yes, that somehow we're always turning our past into stories. We're always trying to sort of wrest meaning out of them where there isn't. But it sets you up with... It's not that Charlie's necessarily an unreliable narrator, but he's... You know, the Charlie that you're meeting in 1997 is different from the Charlie that you're meeting as the sort of the overall narrator. And again, I think that passage that he writes very well about the kind of milieu, you know, it's a similar place to where Nick Hornby was in High Fidelity. You know, he just writes very good about that sort of ordinary English life, you know, people going to the pub and drinking too much and not being able to express their feelings and sense of wasted kind of opportunity and not leaving them at the hometown and not really getting a kind of a grasp on.
Yeah.
Whereas Fran for Charlie represents this, you know, she's cool and introduces him to all sorts of stuff.
And their parents have wine with dinner and have books on the shelves.
And herbs in their cooking.
Oh, yes, that's a wonderful passage about this. Yeah. That's brilliant. But there's a wonderful thing he says, you know, actually, I go and see these kind of arty movies and I understand them just as well as she does. You know, maybe the whole education thing is overrated. Without giving spoilers away, it's not a happy ending, but it's not a tragedy either. It doesn't end up with both the main protagonists dead. I'm sorry.
Sorry, listeners.
Yeah.
And I wanted to mention a couple of the really nice set pieces, which are two parties. One is the final sort of school disco. And then there's a wonderful point there's a very clever way in which he reveals at what time of day suddenly this happens, you know, which is hilarious. And that thing where, you know, a bit like a game of British Bulldogs or something, the girls and the boys are either side of the gymnasium and you know, the music's ramped up and they've kind of hidden some bottles like behind some gym stools and all the rest of it, which is lovely. And then the one where they take a pill and or take a quarter of a pill each at a kind of big house party thrown by actual grown-ups with nice sort of Italian furniture in a modernist house. And they have a wonderful time and he and Fran sort of disappear into the night. And it's deeply romantic and beautifully drawn, both of those scenes of kind of completely innocent, Well, but in both cases, completely innocent, wonderful partying. He's brilliant on that. And that's somewhere between nostalgia and just effortless kind of writing. And again, I could see the sort of filmic quality of that.
Set pieces of that, begging out to be, you know, kind of the swaying, drunken camera angles. But as you say, there's an innocence to it, which is... He doesn't betray that at any point in the book. There is, you know, you don't feel that he's about to turn cynical on you, and actually Charlie overcomes his. It's about young people and confidence, and you know I think that as I say, if the dialogue between Fran and Charlie had been any less funny and quick, I mean it's really really it's great dialogue.
It does, yeah. It sort of stands and falls on the quality of that. The specificity of that language and that relationship. Okay, Georgina, we're going to talk about further reading. Sounds like I've set you some prep. and you've chosen Deborah McGar's The Carer. As you said, this is a story that's perhaps not far from home both ways. Talk us through this one.
So the book's just come out, and this is Debbie's possibly 20th book, I think, and people will remember her. She wrote the book on which the film The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel was based, Tulip Fever. And I mean, she's very well known and a big bestseller. And I think this book was quite a risk for her. It doesn't exactly follow the same path. I know that she parted company with her publisher halfway through, and I think that there were some disagreements with actually how this book would go. And in fact, the book has a massive twist in it. And I don't know whether that was as a result of her changing direction after she changed her publisher. Although when you read the book, you can see that there are little clues right from the beginning that this is not going to turn out how you think it is. So the premise is that this old man, he has an OBE, he's a distinguished scientist, he's a, you know, a pillar of the community, has two adult children, his wife is now dead, and they employ a carer who turns up driving her Fiat Panda with her bobble hat. She's got good sturdy legs, and she and the old man go off, and she gets him into scratch cards, and they go to Nando's this whole thing, where he just changes, and the two adult children of course are so grateful, and again, having been in this position, I know you're just like, I don't care that you're stealing the silver. Please just turn up tomorrow and change the adult diaper. Mm. You know, it's that way in which people get so dependent on that kind of help. And in a way, the sort of echoing that relationship that we had in Nichols' book as well. So this is a fun book. She's a funny writer, but actually there's a lot of emotional exploration, I guess, going on. And there's a man in there who's writing a novel, which is a kind of history of Radnorshire, and it's but written in ancient dialect that he's not able to speak. And it's a hilarious book. But Debbie herself had all sorts of issues with her own mother, who ended up going to prison for murder. Which is quite an extraordinary story, which she recounts. We did an interview a little while ago, so that's on Meet the Writer. So I'm not going to tell you the story now. You have to listen to that episode of Meet the Writer.
Tune in, gang. Yeah, exactly.
She's just a great observer of human nature and sort of brings that out. And I think that is what makes it funny, because the subject matter itself could be quite dark. And at one point, you suspect a terrible crime, but I'm not going to say any more about that.
That is The Carer by Deborah McGar. Thanks, Georgina. Oh, we should say tune in to Meet the Writers.
Yes.
Search for the Deborah McGar episode on monocle.com/radio. John, don't worry, we can plug back this as well, obviously. John, you've chosen Preeti Teenage's We That Are Young. And there's obviously a thematic consistency with this in the Nichols.
Well, it's funny, two of the books I've loved most in the last year that I read, one was this and one was Alan Isler's The Prince of West End Avenue, which is about putting on a performance of Hamlet in a Upper West Side retirement home. elderly, Jewish kind of.
Yeah.
She's gloriously funny, brilliant first novel. This is also a brilliant first novel. We That Are Young is a retelling. This is. I'm intrigued by how Shakespeare is still kind of quickening and inspiring the imaginations of contemporary writers. It's absolutely... there in Sweet Sorrow, as I say, the Alan Isler book is full of Hamlet, and this book is really about the retelling of the Lear story through an Indian company, an incredibly successful multinational Indian company, the head of which is Devraj. And he has three daughters, and his wife had died previously through kind of racial violence in the north of India. And it's the story of the breaking up of the company, and the three daughters are appalling, one less appalling than the others. But it's all the themes of Lear transported into contemporary India, and it's really contemporary. It's not literary India. This is the India of you know, high tech, massive poverty, yeah. The two things living side by side. It's mostly set in Delhi. The language in it is incredibly rich and intense. I think I said that I hadn't read a novel set in India that had impressed me probably since Midnight's Children. You know, there are sort of tick boxes that you can have for books that are set in India that this book completely ignores. It feels incredibly urgent, political. It was set during the anti-poverty riots in 2001. There's lots and lots of kind of intrigue around the business and what does it mean to have a multinational business in a country where it's the biggest democracy in the world, but also the highest levels of poverty. But you know, you come down to Lear in the end.
It's one man going mad.
It's one man going mad with his daughters trying to stitch him up. I mean, it's an astonishing first novel. It won the Desmond Elliott Prize for best first novel. I'm also, it just sort of kind of, it stuck in my head as, without being a plug for Backlisted, but Priti came on and did one of the best ones I think we've done on Toni Morrison's Beloved, which is a book that she's inspired by, and she talked incredibly eloquently about it. But talking to her afterwards, she comes from Letchworth, which could very easily be the setting of, of Sweet Sorrow.
Yeah.
But it's even makes the kind of the act. I mean, she's an academic at Warwick, and she's an activist as well. But the book feels, I mean, it's not unsurprising being bought by Sonny Mater himself at Knopf and publishing there. It was published by the excellent independent Gally Beggar here.
Yeah.
But every now and then you get a writer who feels fully formed, and you know, she can do the big set pieces, she can do the dialogue, she can do. But for me, it just, again, it reminds you that Shakespeare gives you some kind of, there's a flavour to the intensity and the quality of both the language. Which is some great stuff in Sweet Sorrow, incidentally, about why don't the guy Charlie says, why doesn't he just say things plainly and straightforwardly?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, doesn't he? Isn't there a bit where he's trying to
get up at dawn? The sun gets up at dawn. Yeah. You know, rather than and
then blow what light from yonder window breaks.
But, yes. Yeah.
And Fran tries to say, well, do you not see that this is, if you say it in this way, this is what it does. It's because we mean what we say, but we never mean what we say, and the poetry is always an attempt to say more about what we really feel. And I felt that very strongly in Preeti's book. It's full of powerful language, and I think one can only look forward to whatever she does next. It's an amazing debut.
Beautifully told, Preeti Teenagers, We That Are Young. Before we go, we should also talk about Charlie's attempts to speak in a Shakespearean idiom during one of those trust exercises or improv sessions. He goes, of love. Frankly, it's been hit and miss. So We That Are Young by Preeti Teenager comes out in paperback on August the 10th. The Carer by Deborah McGar is out now, and you can listen to Georgina's interview with McGar on meetthewriters@monocle.com. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Sweet Sorrow by David Nicholls is out now, published by Hodder and Stoughton. Thank you very much to my guests, John Mitchinson and Georgina Godwin. The Monocle Culture Show is produced, of course, by Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. We'll be back at the same time next week. For the time being, thanks for tuning in.